So I think that it is really not possible to talk about love without starting with Titanic. Bear with me for a second. I remember when I watched the movie Titanic, all 3 hours of it, knowing how it would end, of course. At the end, or near the end, not quite at the end, as Leonardo DiCaprio was sinking, I had the exact same feeling that I had at the end of the movie Ghost, where Patrick Swayze was ascending to heaven, which was, I pity her next boyfriend. I mean, how do you compete? Right? What can you possibly say after someone has died saving your life in a monumental disaster? I got tickets to a play. I mean, how do you compete with that? And then, in both cases, I was reminded of the fact that not only does her next boyfriend have to compete, so does every man in the movie. That is, everyone who's sitting next to someone. Because they've just been exposed to the image of what love is supposed to be, and they turn to the Schmendrick sitting next to them, who would probably have just let them drown. And they think, really, I belong up there and not here. And the reverse is true. I mean, you can choose your movie. Depends whether you want to look at it in terms of a female or a male hero. But the same question applies, which is, what do you do when you're fed on dreams? And how is it that you negotiate life when you're constantly being presented with the unreality of fantasy? Yeats has a line like that, that the heart was fed on dreams and the heart has grown brutal from the fare. In other words, when you're constantly fed dreams, it's very difficult to retain the kind of flexibility and compassion that reality demands, and that's why I want to talk about love tonight. Because actually, the Jewish tradition doesn't think of love the way we're taught to think about love. And the way that you can see this is by the examples of love that we are asked to observe in the Bible. V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, you should love your neighbor as yourself. V'ahavta et Adonai Elohecha, you should love the Lord your God. And everybody who reads that has the same reaction, which is, how can you possibly command me to love? And in fact, it chooses instances where you might not naturally love. You might not naturally love God. You might implore that God give you stuff. You might be afraid of God. But love isn't necessarily the first impulse that everyone has. And that certainly isn't true toward your neighbor. Notice that nowhere in the Bible does it say love your parents, love your children, love your spouse. Why? Because that's how you might conceive of love. You might think of love as the emotion that comes when you contemplate somebody whom you love. But by deliberately making love about someone whom you wouldn't normally love, I mean, really, do you love your neighbor? We live in Los Angeles, we don't know our neighbors. Right? How can we love them? By saying you're supposed to love your neighbor, I think it should persuade us that ahava in this context means something different from the love that we assume is love in American romantic culture. Because love is not actually, in the Jewish tradition, fundamentally an emotion. Emotions are very tricky. and very various and very shifting. And when you feel one thing, you can't imagine feeling another. It's what Emerson said, my moods don't believe each other. Right? When you're angry, you can't imagine being nice. And when you're nice, you can't imagine, what were you so angry about? And so if you're going to choose someone with whom to spend your life, how you feel about them is not always the best guide. At least, not according to the Jewish tradition. Because feelings are unsteady. And one of the illusions of feelings is that they'll last forever. But feelings change. They wax and they wane. Love in the Jewish tradition is not an emotion. And it's not a behavior. It's rather an enacted emotion. It's an emotion that finds its way into certain behaviors. And you judge whether you love someone by both sides of it. If you feel passionately and you act cruelly, that's not love. If you act kindly but you feel nothing, that's not love. Love is to feel and act lovingly. That's love. And therefore, you judge someone not solely by how you feel about them, but by behavior. I have said it before, I'll say it again. If you go out with someone who is cruel to the waiter, that's a bad sign. If you go out with someone who's cruel to you, it's obviously a worse sign. Now, I don't mean to make love too simple. There are all sorts of complicated and messy pieces to any relationship, to any love relationship, certainly to any marriage, to any family. We all know that. As my friend Joseph Telushkin likes to say, his mother told him when he was young, the only happy families she knows are families she doesn't know very well. Right? As soon as you get to know a family, you realize it's never so simple. But even with that, and even with the reality that our egos are powerfully invested in not only how we feel about someone else, but how someone else feels about us. Right? And there are all sorts of clever little poems about how two lovers looking in each other's eyes see themselves, right? Because you can be reflected in someone else's eye. With all of that, the fact remains that if you are looking for someone or evaluating someone and trying to decide, is this somebody you could live with? How you feel about them is only a piece, and sometimes not the most important piece, of that puzzle. And how you feel about someone, how you really feel about someone, is best judged the same way that you should judge your character in general. If you want to know what you're like, don't consult how you feel. Look at what you do. That's how you judge your own character. You may think you're a people person, but if you actually spend all your time alone, you're probably not. Right? Or you may think that really what you want is to be this sort of individual who does that or devotes their life to something, but the truth is, that's not how you live. And even though it's good to aspire, it's not good to lie to yourself. And love is the playing field of self-deception. That's where we all deceive ourselves. And part of the reason that we deceive ourselves is because it's much easier to deceive someone else if you've deceived yourself. I really, really do like her. But if you're going to make a commitment that is more than a Hallmark card with a nod to tomorrow, then you have to be ruthless in your evaluation of yourself. Because remember, a lifetime is, from one perspective, a very long time. And you're going to go through lots of different experiences. and have lots of different emotions. And everybody who is in a long-term relationship or a marriage knows that part of the dynamic of any long-term relationship is the gradual accumulation of grievances, right? That's what you do. You store them up, and you don't forget. And they are available to be taken out when the occasion warrants, which means that you better be sure that you have actually found somebody that you want to talk to every day. Somebody who's kind. Not somebody who's perfect, but somebody who's kind. Somebody who, even though you will be angry with them, and you will inevitably, and with yourself, you will be able in one way or another to work through that. Someone who, if you didn't feel the passion that you feel at the moment, you still would want to wake up to tomorrow. In the Torah class last Thursday morning, we have a Torah class from 8:15 to 9:15. You're all invited. It's in English. You don't have to have any past experience. And I'll tell you what we studied this past Thursday. We studied how Jacob thinks he's marrying Rachel. And in fact, Rachel's father, Laban, doesn't want Jacob to marry Rachel because Leah's the older sister and he wants him to marry Leah first. So Jacob thinks that he's going to bed that night with Rachel, but in fact he wakes up and in his bed is Leah. So obviously this is a problematic story, right? I mean, Jacob wasn't that stupid, right? How could he not know that the person in his bed was, and the rabbis give all sorts of fanciful interpretations which don't have to detain us at the moment, but there's a beautiful mystical interpretation that does actually say something to us. It says this is really an allegory, because the person you go to sleep with at night is not necessarily the person you wake up to in the morning. It's true not only for a night, it's true for a lifetime. The person you go to sleep with the first night that you sleep with them may not be the person that you wake up to 10 years later. So part of what you have to ask yourself is, even drained of passion, do I want to wake up to this person 10 years later, 15 years later, 30 years later, 50 years later? If you don't ask yourself that question, or if you ask yourself that question but you dismiss it too quickly, then you're doing yourself and the other person a tremendous disservice by being dishonest with yourself and with them. I speak all the time, as you might imagine, to couples who don't succeed. And when you ask them what happened, and whether what made them eventually not succeed was there at the beginning or did it happen later, 98% of the time, it was there at the beginning. You didn't pay attention to it, you didn't notice it, you didn't want to admit it, but it was there. This shouldn't discourage you, but rather redirect you. There are lots and lots of kind, good, caring, capable of committed people out there. A lot of them. But when you decide to spend your life with someone, make sure that it is someone that you want to spend your life with. Not tomorrow, and not next week, and not a vacation in Hawaii, but your life. That it's someone you want to grow old with, someone you want to raise children with, somebody whose values you want to see your children realize. Make sure that one day, if you see your child grown up and it looks like your spouse, that you'll be pleased and not upset. It's not a bad measure for whether this is the person you want to spend your years with. That's what love is in a Jewish context. Love isn't only how you feel. Love is how you act with what you feel. Love is the kindness you express. It's the goodness you show. So when you say you should love your neighbor as yourself, it means you should treat your neighbor lovingly. When we say, V'ahavta et Adonai Elohecha, you should love the Lord your God, it means that you should act in this world as though you love God because God wants you to be a certain way. You're a child of God. You want God to be proud of the way that you behave in this world. You want to find someone else who shares the fundamental values, outlook, and appreciation that you have. And if you do, that doesn't mean that every day will be easy. But in the accumulation of years, as you look back, you will feel gratified and uplifted, and you will know that you have loved and been loved. And that is, I suppose, in the end, God's greatest blessing. Shabbat Shalom.